Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 219 featuring Chris Blythe of What's Good Studios. Now, Chris is an amazing person. He has a sense of humor and an enthusiasm that's absolutely infectious. He's originally from Scotland, and he worked there for a while doing some game stuff and doing all kinds of interesting work there. He eventually moved over to California. He worked at Digital Domain, which is where I knew him. He was in a commercial department for a while, and he did obviously some visual effects there, but he also directed a lot. He was directing, and he did several feature projects as well. But then he eventually moved to Nairobi in Kenya, and he's done some really cool work there. And I'm just absolutely mind blown by what he does. A lot of philanthropy work that he does. He's bringing his filmmaking sensitivities, as well as a lot of the technology that he knows how to use, to sort of bring content and shows and different ideas to that part of the world. And has done just a great job of making, you know, the world a better place through what he knows how to do. Just kind of reminds you that, you know, using the things you know, you can basically always find a way to help people and be a great person. And Chris is a perfect example of that. So really, really happy that he was able to come onto the podcast. We don't really have any big announcements in terms of products this right now. I think we have one product release that came out this last week, which was V-Ray for Cinema 4D, has a hot fix on that. So if you guys are V-Ray for Cinema 4D people, you should check that out and make sure you get your fix on that. We have a couple of events on April 9th, which will be very soon after this podcast comes out. There's going to be a free webinar on V-Ray for Next for Rhino. So if you guys want to get onto that, just go to rchaosgroup.com, go to the events section, and you will be able to find that free webinar. So go sign up and do that. We also have on April 16th, there's going to be V-Ray Days in Budapest. So if you're going to be in Budapest on April 16th and you'd like to attend that, go check that out. Again, that is also on our events section. We will be at FMX April 30th through May 3rd. I think we're having V-Ray Days on May 1st, but check your calendar for that. And we'll be announcing all the different speakers that will be at V-Ray Days for FMX 2019. So check that out. And of course, I've mentioned many, many times, May 16th through the 18th is Total Chaos 2019. Very exciting. And that's happening in Sofia, Bulgaria. And we have some amazing speakers coming up. Including, it's not on our page just yet, but he will be soon, is going to be Paul Debevic, who I just got off the phone with him the other day. And he's going to be coming and talking about the amazing work that he's been doing over at Google and their VR projects over there. So very exciting to see Paul there. He's a good friend of mine and an amazing speaker and really, honestly, a legend in the world of computer graphics. So very excited to have that. And I think that's about it. With that being said, enjoy this amazing podcast with Chris Blythe. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
We got a good deal because these are the old Sony ones.
They're great. They've been making them for 20 years. Absolutely nothing.
They're the same thing.
Yeah.
And
the only difference is they've got the blue thing down the side. It doesn't say digital anymore. It says professional.
It says professional.
It used to say, the red ones used to say digital.
And we still have, hold on. This one is still red, I think.
There we go. Going to do a bit of this here.
Oh, here it is. It got on the ground. This one, I think, is red.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. There you go.
Digital.
And it says digital.
I'm going to switch all my things
from
to silent.
Digital. Yes. Yeah, so, these headphones were actually pretty... I think we got a deal on them. Like somehow we saw something on Amazon or something where you could get them for like $70.
Yeah. I got mine. I just bought
And we
bunch.
Bought like six of them.
Yeah. I bought a few pairs. I bought like, I think three or four, okay. Maybe. Probably an even number. And Yeah, they tend to. It's difficult.
You know, it's funny because I was saying, it's like these things are classic. They're like tanks, these headphones, and they're perfect for monitor, right? Because they're not enhanced or anything. They're just a clean headset. Just
clean.
And I was watching Frasier because somehow my son likes to watch Frasier.
How old's your son?
9.
Oh, wow. That's funny.
Yeah. Yep. So Frasier is like one of his favorite shows. But I was watching him and was like, hey, they're wearing the same stuff. It's like, and that's an old show. Yeah.
And they had cathode ray tubes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back when you had electrons fired at your face. Mm-hmm. All day.
All day.
All day, my dear.
Yeah, that's when you were like, you may have had a legitimate reason for your marriage. It's like, don't stare at the TV so close. That actually probably may have had some.
But it made us better. That's I mean, look at us.
Yeah.
See?
Look at us.
Fantastic.
All we have now is just a slight glow from an LCD monitor.
You know what gets me is that when you play an old video game and you watch it on a CRT, it looks amazing.
It looks amazing.
And then when you play it on an LCD, you're like, what are all these chunky things?
Yes.
It's terrible.
We did this thing at we were doing an exhibit that for an architecture thing talking about the history of computer graphics and architecture. And there was a video done of a visualization by SOM, and they did it with back in 1984, using probably at that time, you know, what they called supercomputers.
And, now called iWatches.
Right. Yeah. And so we bought an old, I believe it was a Sony television from 1984.
A Trinitron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how to get an MP4 file to play on a Trinitron TV.
Oh, man, that's funny.
That was really tough. But we got it, and there was some warmth about it, you know?
Well, it's the way that the pixels just smear together.
Yeah.
So that
they're smeared.
You're now, right. What you also get, if you're back in the old days when I did video games, that was when people were on not RGB monitors. A lot of them were on composite monitors. Mm-hmm. So because of the frequency and the spacing of the pixels, you would get a certain buzzing and a certain color that you could get that would give you a certain edge.
Right.
And there were certain people, there was a guy called Simon Butler was his name. He's a real pixel pusher. And he would do stuff you look at and you go, that's more resolution than we're getting on the screen. It looked amazing.
How is he doing that?
He would test it out he'd have his computer, but then he'd see it on a TV screen, and by adjusting the values, you'd get certain buzzing or certain colors that would look, because they were adjacent or there was a gap, they'd get a certain look.
Right.
And then you would like, oh, we'll use that for a tail edge of a feather or something like that. And it was incredible. And they'd cycle these colors, they'd just do little animations.
Wow.
Some of the stuff was just bananas. And that for me, I remember when I got my first computer, which is a Commodore PET. And that was when I was like, I remember there was like on the front edge of the keyboard, there was all these different graphics, like all those ANSI graphics, I guess.
Yeah.
And one of them was like a thing that was like a line at the bottom. And there was another one was a line a bit, you know, and so forth. And then I animated this thing going up and down. And then I did another one. It was going along like that. I was like, this is amazing. And I was just doing it with like printing to the screen. And then I realized, well, I could actually put it to a memory address, and then it's all nice and smooth. And then,
wait, now.
And then later on, when I got a Commodore 64, it's like, well, now I can use that as a sprite, and I can move that. You know, but then you were really pushing stuff that was, I loved it.
It was hacky, and that's the best part of it, right?
Yeah, but now you look at that, you look like an Atari 400, and you put it onto an LCD monitor. But now this kit that you can still get on eBay for that.
Right.
And there's a guy that's the English guy that lives here that he shows all these kits. Mm-hmm. The stuff's amazing, and he does all this retro computing. But the sad thing is that he's trying to make it so it works on an LCD monitor. But when you put it onto an LCD monitor, it's sharp. But when you play a game, it's horrible looking.
Right.
It looks way worse than you ever remember it.
Right.
And then you combine that with interlacing back then too.
Right. Yeah.
You're
Those were all considered defects, by the way.
That's right. It was really literally defects. And that flicker was like, we've got to get rid of that flicker.
Yeah.
And then we got rid of the flicker. Like, oh, why does it look so chunky? You know, it's like, you know what it reminds me of? Like an adventure game.
Uh-huh.
If it was like, it was written down, it says, you wake up, the floor is wet and cobbled. Mm-hmm. There's a small window. with light peering through, your brain fills the line for you.
Yes.
Your brain's filling all the graphics in for you.
Yeah.
But if it shows you a picture, you're like, and your brain does nothing, and then you don't have to think of anything. So in the
your imagination is way better than anything.
Yeah. And so that's why I think the text-based games in a certain way were like, they do these brain scans of like when kids are playing games, mm-hmm. and if everything's going, like even Overwatch, which is just bananas, mm-hmm. I have to like have a whole bunch of coffee just to keep up with what's happening on Overwatch, and my son's playing it when he's like half asleep. But that's everything's been given to your brain. You don't need to think of anything.
Right.
And so the actual brain activity is just the basic stuff, your basic hunting and killing that's on.
Right.
Any of your creativity is, it's all off.
Interesting.
You know, so computer graphics is killing us basically, as it really has slowly done over the years.
All right. Well, we're going to have to go through a journey, you and I, between the next hour. So
all right.
The journey we have to take is what took you from that pet computer and how did that end up going all the way to Nairobi?
Oh, right. Wow.
It's a long journey.
It is.
It's a big journey.
It's many days.
Yeah. But let's see what we can do.
All righty.
All right. So that pet computer.
Yeah.
Where that was your first computer.
Oh, yes.
Where was that?
Oh, I remember. It was 1846. We'd come back from playing cricket, I believe. And somebody says, here's a computer. And we didn't know what to do with it.
No, my dad brought back a computer from the college that he worked at. He was a lecturer. And my dad, he was a total visionary. He was an artist. He was a musician. He was interior. He did everything. He was a Renaissance man. And I think that kind of rubbed off on me, even though he was way more classically trained than me, but he brought home this computer. And my dad, even though he was right, he wanted me to try programming and doing things in there. And I liked pressing the buttons, of course. I was 8 years old. But then when I saw what could be done and I followed these, like really, there was a basic manual. I could see that like I can make mistakes here and everything's clean.
Okay.
And that's what I really liked. I'm left-handed, so all my paperwork and penmanship is always horribly messy.
Yep.
And this gave me, I'm a bit dyslexic as well, so it gave me an avenue of
Welcome to the club.
Clearly. And I can think clearly and see clearly, and it allowed me to think. So it actually started off as programming. But then when I realized I could move things around on the screen, and then I could actually, instead of printing things and having to redraw and do stupid things in BASIC, mm-hmm. I could write to the actual video memory address and then start moving things around that way.
Right.
And that was with them. I'd actually move them down in memory addresses and it would be kind of like a smooth scrolling thing.
Right.
And that's what made me do my first Pac-Man game, which was...
Wow.
Which, after that, my dad got me a VIC-20, which had...
Nice.
Now, believe it or not, this computer had just over 3.5 kilobytes of memory. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do?
I know.
Are you going to go to the moon? You could go to the moon.
Three and a half kilobytes
of memory.
Yep.
Shortly after that, I got a 16K RAM pack. I know.
For the VIC-20.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I got a whole new walk with it. I got a whole new walk.
Probably cost a pretty penny.
Yeah.
To get 16K of memory.
It was like that.
Right.
It's like Saturday Night Fever. I was John Travolta with my 16K RAM pack walking along. So, but that's when I really started to get into programming. But the programming for me, I was always into art, and I would like to do. I remember seeing way back then. Of course, mm-hmm. we all saw Tron. How can you do 3D? And that was impossible back then.
Right.
But I remember one of my biggest programs that I actually got from someone else was doing hidden line removal for like rotating a 3D cube.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that was like, this is a lot of work.
Yeah.
So for me, that was my first kind of, even though I went on to study computer programming and you know, did all that stuff, my heart wasn't in programming. My heart was like, I want to make things on the screen. At the same time I was doing music, I actually built my own 4-track recorder from a reel-to-reel.
Really?
I couldn't get a 4-track machine.
Okay.
And I was watching a TV program called Blue Peter, and this guy called Mike Oldfield did all this multi-track recording, and it was just
Mike Oldfield, Tubular Bells.
Yeah, and that totally blew me away.
Yeah.
And also back then, there was another guy called Jean-Michel Jarre.
Jean-Michel Jarre,
who had he did this thing called the Concerts in China. I was 10, 11 years old.
Yeah.
And I saw this thing that he had called a Fairlight, which was blew my mind as this
his,
the world.
His dad was Maurice Jarre.
Maurice Jarre,
yeah.
who did some incredible scores.
Yes. He did Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago.
Yeah. And he did another one called, there was another one. It was great. It was a science fiction one he did. He didn't get on with his dad, apparently. Sad.
Jean-Michel Janeca.
Yeah, interesting. He was a estranged father.
Interesting.
So anyway, those are my kind of early influences.
Yeah.
But I always wanted to. So years later, actually, one of my first things that I did, I had a copy of a Pac-Man game. It was a smooth-scrolling Pac-Man game
nice.
On a Commodore VIC-20, which didn't have sprites. It was like, but it was fairly easy. It was going in one direction, you know,
right.
left, right, up, down. It's not crazy now thinking about it. But back right. then, that was cool. You know,
right.
It was, you know. And then I remember I was super bored at maths and all that kind of stuff. But then my teacher, called Sinclair Watson, my dad invited him to come home and see what I'd been programming. And then all of a sudden this guy he looked at me in a totally different way because I was making things. But a lot of that was I was actually doing stuff to make graphics on the screen.
Right.
Or make music, which I couldn't do in the VIC-20. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. You know, then I got a Commodore 64, Amiga, blah, 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 and it all went from there.
Right.
So when I started doing stuff on the Amiga, that's when the graphic stuff really, really took off. And it was a 68000. Oh, my God. Programming and assembly on that thing, it was bananas.
Right.
You know, it was great. And then through a long story, I actually needed to – I actually went into electronics engineering and programming. And I worked all over the world, actually, luckily enough. But through a very, very strange – which I could tell you if you want. I don't even want to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So basically, I was in the Philippines, and I was in very young, but I was working as a young engineer, and that's where they made the Commodore Amiga.
Oh.
And I thought, well, I was even seeing it being used at the airport, and I saw it being used. I saw it literally being used in
kiosks as a workstation, almost.
Well, for graphics on the TV.
Right.
Using a thing called Scala back then. I think that's what it was called.
Right.
If I remember correctly, my dear fellow. And then, so what I did was I thought, well, I'm here and this is where they make them.
Right.
I'm going to go and find out and visit them. So I took a driver to the factory and it was closed.
The Amiga factory?
Yeah. And it was closed. It was literally shuttered.
What?
I thought, what's going on? So I left a voice message with the editor of Amiga Format, right? And this story goes on a bit.
Okay, now keep it going.
But the editor from Amiga Format is a guy called Marcus Dyson. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, I was thinking of doing a story. I'm out here in the Philippines. I'm seeing these in the Amiga out here. But I've gone to the Amiga factory and it's closed. I was going to do a piece. I was thinking you might want to do a piece on being out in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And I didn't hear back from him. And I left him another message of other things that I'd found out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I called, and then it went to, and he said, oh, he doesn't work here anymore. I was like, oh. And I just got a recent edition of Amiga Format, and I knew that he was from the Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that he liked Team 17 because they make good games.
True.
And he'd kind of, you know, there was competition for Team 17, and a visit to Team 17, and he just noticed a couple of other things going on. And I basically, because I was close to the magazine and I followed this guy, I was like, I think I know where he's gone.
He's gone to Team 17.
And so what I did was I called up Team 17.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman, she answered the phone, receptionist, and she said, hi. I said, is Marcus Dyson there? And she went, yeah, he's just walking in through the door. And he went, hello? I went, hi, it's Chris from the Philippines. He goes, oh my, how did you find me? I went, well, I kind of put two and two together. He goes, I left. No one knows I'm here. No one knows I'm here.
Wow.
But you found me. And he goes, what are you doing? When are you coming back to the UK? I said, I'll be back in a couple of weeks. I said, actually, why I was wanting to call him was I was going to buy a PC or an Amiga to do graphics.
Uh-huh.
PCs were really cheap. You got a whole bunch of software, but I want to get an Amiga because I want to do sound and graphics. That's the whole thing. I always want to do more than one thing, which is, you know, the bane, you know, I should have stuck with doing one thing, which is most people do, especially in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, why don't you come down to my housewarming party? And I was like, all right. And so the day I arrived back was the day my Amiga actually got delivered.
Okay.
And then that evening I went down to this party and met all these people and they said, oh, what do you do? Now, during this time, I'd had an Amiga 500 and I'd been making graphics. And they said, oh, do you work in games? I'm like, no, I don't. What do you do? I said, well, I make graphics. They said, oh, do you have anything? And I showed them some things and they went, and the guy, Martin Brown, who owned Team 17 Software, went, he was paralytic drunk. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, you should come work for us. I'm like, okay. Like, but it didn't happen.
Okay.
Until they got this project. I helped on other projects with a game called Team 17.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually through John Allardyce.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So me and John Allardyce got friends from that party.
Yep.
He was still up in Edinburgh. So I'd go and visit him up in Edinburgh and see him working. He was working at Waterside Productions, I believe, which is up there. And I remember seeing his Amiga 4000 with no lid on it running Light Rave.
Light Rave. Okay. Yeah,
to get Light Wave going, right? And we, you know, sparked up a friendship from there. And he said, come and hang down and, you know, do some stuff. I ended up doing some sound effects and then being in this Tower Assault intro, which was the worst acted intro you've ever seen. It was like a space opera, but it was badly acted. But it was one of the first ones that had full 3D animation. And it was really, I mean, what John was doing then was like, holy crap, people haven't thought about doing this stuff before. And my hat really firmly goes off to John for like pioneering doing new stuff that other people had not done at that time and wanting to go further than he was like, this is what we're doing now. He already had plans to do something else. Mm-hmm. He was always great with camera, just really good with digital camera, you know, with camera stuff. And then one thing led to another, nothing happened until Worms came along.
Okay.
And then John basically, John and Marcus and they all said, like, well, let's get Chris in to help
to do,
do the animation.
Yep.
And so that's where we started. We started with our 8 or 12 megabyte Amigas doing the animation. And we literally had to, if we had a tree loaded in, right? Can we load another? Ah, it's crashed. Right. Reload the scene. Just load one tree this time. Okay. Right. Will it render? And then we'd use this thing called the NewTek Screamer.
Okay.
Which was two RISC processors in a box, and you'd control it from an Amiga.
Oh, wow.
And send the commands to it, and then it would render. And it was called a Raptor. That's what it's called. And it was
NewTek made it?
NewTek.
So they made hardware?
They did, yeah. They made the Screamer, and then I think they got another company to make the Raptor for them.
Okay.
It was a separate company. So anyway, Team 17 had one of the only ones in the UK.
Yeah.
And then from that, we were trying all sorts of stuff out. But even though those processors, I think, they had way more memory, that like 32 megs or something like that. We couldn't ever use that because the Amiga only had 16 megs of memory, but then 4 was used up to do this and that. And we ended up with 11 megs of memory to anything you want.
Sure.
So, but we were really pumping out some really cool stuff. Then when John moved on and I worked on Worms 2, kind of, I spearheaded that myself, along with Rory McLeish, and Mark Taylor. And we worked as a great little team. And then after that, there was another guy called Neil South who jumped in. He was going to be basically my replacement. And then I kind of got the idea. I did that. It was great. I did other things at Team 17 and I loved it.
Right.
But I kind of felt like, well, I'm only going to be doing intros. And I want to do more things. And I remember there was a guy called Charlie Wallace who worked with us, and he now works at Octane.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Okay. Yep.
And he worked with us at Team 17.
Mm-hmm.
He's a direct descendant of William Wallace.
Okay.
My family is Bruce, the Bruce family.
Interesting.
So we've got the Wallace and the Bruce family descendants both working at Team 17, which is interesting.
Interesting.
And John is kind of Scottish as well. So there's a lot of Scottish people going on. And Rory was there too.
Rory's one of the most Scottish visual effects artists I've ever worked with.
There is other visual effects artists that are Scottish, but both of them, when they get drunk, I've known Rory for 569 years.
Yeah.
And I still can't understand what he's saying when he's drunk. I look at him like, I think he's trying to communicate. I can tell. It's like a language. It's almost like he's sentient.
Yeah.
And then you realize, no, he's just drunk.
He's just drunk. Yeah. But it did take me about a year to understand him, honestly speaking. And this is when he was not drunk necessarily.
Well, see, if you're drunk, then you can understand him. See, that's
right.
The key.
Right. It's true.
Yeah,
it's
there's a common language there.
It's true. But he was, I mean, one of my favorite, Rory quotes when I was working with him on, I think it was on iRobot.
Love that.
Chris, can you come over here? I think my speaker is all fucked up. It's like something about... Specular. Okay, now I got it.
Right,
yes,
gotcha.
Let me go look at it. But
I shall pause things off.
Yeah, he was great. I loved Rory.
Rory's a great artist.
And he's not only a great artist, he's a great writer. Mm. His emails were like a work of art. They were
fantastic.
So funny.
You know, I've never experienced that before.
Yeah, his emails were so funny and such prose, and they were just cracked me up. In fact, I think when we were on... when we were on Day After Tomorrow, Melanie would publish his notes for his time card because in his notes.
Oh, right. I remember now.
He would actually reference what music he was listening to.
I remember now.
And it was really
funny.
Now
I remember, yeah. Yeah.
It's like, here's what I did today. I listened to the B-52s. I listened to whatever it was. It was like whatever. I did not, definitely not B-52s. It would have probably been something more along
the lines. Very prog rock.
Probably. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you've heard of his, he's a great musician.
Oh, he's a fantastic musician.
He's fantastic.
And he plays by ear.
He does?
Yeah, he. That's what I remember. He's amazing.
A lot of people use ears, you know.
Yeah, I know. It hurts a little.
He plays on ears. He plays people's ears.
Yeah, he's really violent. Amazing musician. No, his guitar is incredible. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, then there's a lot of talent. I think that's the thing that you find, obviously, as well, is that when you're stepping into 3D, you find that all of a sudden you'll find people that do all these other things amazingly well. And that's why I felt
it's a gene, right? So that gene is going to create different creative nerves.
Yeah.
So you'll find someone who's really good also at photography or also really good at writing or good at acting.
The one thing that I always find, though, is that artists are artists. They're not businessmen. That's the worst part.
That's the problem.
One of the things that I always found that I gave this advice to a lot of people, that people say, well, I'm here. I'm doing cars, but I want to do humans, or I want to do this, I want to do that. And I can't, the supervisor do dailies, walk through and see them. Mm-hmm. And my number one piece of advice was, put it up in your cube. Print something out. Make it look nice. Mm-hmm. Make it look like a finished piece of artwork. Whatever you want to do, people are going to say, "Hey, they're looking at your car, whatever." Mm-hmm. Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Bring up the spec a bit on this, and then we can whatever. Mm-hmm. Do the thing with the thing, and then they go, "Oh, what's that in your wall? Oh, yeah, I made it. Really? Oh, hey." And then all of a sudden, they get pulled into other things.
Yep.
You know, and I find that's a good thing that can happen. But at the same time, I think, we as a bunch of people have been obviously taken advantage of over the years.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously, I used to have lots of different business cards made up.
Okay.
I had a visual effects supervisor, I had a director one, and I'd keep them separate. I had to keep tabs on who I'd given them to. So I don't give a visual effects supervisor one a director one.
Right.
They go, wait a minute, you're stepping on my things.
Right.
You don't want all that stuff happening.
Yep.
So yeah, so it's that I found that started from Team 17. That was Charlie Wallace. Mm-hmm. That was John Allardyce and Rory McLeish.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember when Rory was applying for the job at Team 17, and we just got on like a house on fire. It was like, yeah, it's done. We're done.
He's so good.
He was on, and he was on 3DS Max, I think, at the 3.
Was he?
Yeah, but not Max. 3DS.
Long.
The winder is winder. It was clockwork back then. You used to have to keep it wound up.
Yeah.
What we did was we employed people to keep the handle cranked, to keep it tight, because you always have to have a tight spring.
Yeah,
you have to have that spring tight for 3DS.
Well, you
to
get
work.
A new spring every upgrade.
Yeah.
So that, because
they gave me a gold spring once.
Nice.
Oh yeah, it's very nice. I put it in a clear box so people could see it. Yeah, it wound itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
Anyway, so that then, so I knew I wanted to work at Digital Domain.
Right.
It was because of Titanic, it was Apollo 13, it was everything that they were doing.
Right.
I think their demos are really cool as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then I met, and then how that happened. Again, I attribute a lot of, I think I can do some things good.
Sure.
But I think we've all had our own share of good luck.
Right.
And I totally would say I've had a great share of good luck.
Oh, yeah.
Being in the right place at the right time, but with the right amount of practice behind you of doing the right thing.
There's luck, and there's also being at the right place at the right time, like you said, because that's without the specific, because if you didn't have the right thing behind you, then
it's pointless.
Would pointless, right?
Yeah.
So there's some talent also.
I was, so what I did was I sent off a whole bunch of demo tapes from the UK of stuff that I'd been working on.
Sure.
I did a little demo reel, put music behind it and the whole thing. Sent it off to a whole bunch of people. And I heard back from a whole bunch of them, funnily enough. And then I said my email address will be this. Now, this is in 1996.
Oof.
I had a pocket Scion computer with a thing called a modem.
Oh, wow.
It is a modem. It modulates.
Yes.
And do you know what it also does? It demodulates also.
Yes.
It's crazy. Audio.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what...
I did the calculation. My first modem was in 1980... 88 or 87.
Wow, you youngster.
Yeah, 1200 baud modem.
1200.
I just told you my internet speed at home now.
Yeah.
It's 265 times, 1,000 times faster than that.
Well, I had my first modem was a 300 by 300.
Yeah.
And I got the one that acoustically coupled.
Yeah, so you have to put the headset down.
I did it specifically.
Like War Games.
So it looked like War Games.
Yeah.
I even found a girlfriend that looked tall that was like that girl, just to have everything the same.
There you go.
I did call myself Matthew, though. Here's my middle name, though. So where was I? Oh, yeah. So I was standing in line.
Yeah.
And I was cold calling Digital Domain.
Okay.
And I was standing, there was a line to see the receptionist.
That's not always successful.
It's not.
Right.
But there was a guy standing beside me and he had a terrible cold and he was sneezing and I went, Gesundheit. And he went, oh, not bless you. I said, no, it's Gesundheit, because that's what we say in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's not. It's not at all. But I was just, talking.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to the front and I had my demo tape and I said, oh, it was Andrea Basada was standing at she was the receptionist.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, I'm here to see Lawrence Plotkin. And
did you have an appointment?
No, he says, and she looked at me and she went, do you have an appointment? And she's smiling at me. And I said, no, I have it. I have some of these though. And I handed over some Tic Tacs as if it was drugs. I said, I have one of these though, like with a wink. And she looked at me and then I didn't realize what she was doing until it was happening. And she goes, so you don't have an appointment, but you're just coming up here wanting to speak to him. He's very busy, you know. And she darted a look over my shoulder, which I didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, you can just ask him yourself. I went, and the guy that had the cold looked at me and he looked at me up and down and went, come on then. And he grabbed my tape.
Wow.
And we went and sat down.
So, that is lucky.
He's the head of HR.
Yeah, I know.
Super nice guy.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. My demo reel played, and as soon as the title would go, he'd like show the title of what I did, how much time it took, what I did. And then it would start, he'd look down, he'd start writing, doing something like this. And then it would finish, and he'd look up at the screen. And I was like, oh, do you, and he did it again. He'd start, and he'd look down. And it was like, and then a phone would ring. Lawrence Plotkin, please call. And he's on the phone like this. Oh, yeah. And he'd look across, it was black. He'd turn away, the video would be playing. And all my bits, he never saw any of them, I'm sure.
Okay.
Right? And then and I thought, well, that's fine. Hey, you know what? I'm here. I'm actually really pleased I got to do this. But yeah. Fair enough. I'm not the right fit, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I remember I actually got offered a job during the interview with Casey and Van Ling. Mm-hmm. And Casey from Band from the Ranch.
Oh, right.
Right. That was during my interview. That was just, And then there was another girl called Rachel from Pixar who was speaking. So, I was like, that's fine. And so I kind of reached up and wanted to shake his hand. I went, well, thank you very much. And he goes, "What? Where are you going? I went, well, I thought we were kind of done here.
Mm-hmm.
And he went, no, I need you to come and meet some people. And I went, okay, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm cool. Everything's under control. I might be. It was like that. And so we went upstairs and I met Eric Barba, Mark Loaf, and a guy called Rob Legato. Probably never heard of him.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all there. And I was like, and I knew the name Eric Barba because I'd heard of Sequest DSV and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But I didn't actually have a reckoning of what he looked like at that point. This was back when the internet was all black and white.
It's funny because we ran into him at lunch.
Yeah, I know, isn't that funny? And then Mark Loaf was there. Yeah. And then but then it was like, oh, this is Rob Legato. I was like,
Rob Legato. Those who don't know, Rob Legato was VFX Supervisor on Titanic.
Yeah. Bobby and, Cake. I
and
gave
he's
him
still,
a name.
He's he a very like, well renowned visual effects supervisor. Yeah.
I've never said that to his face. Anyway, he didn't know me from Adam.
I should try to get Rob on this.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where is he? Lion King. I know that was going on.
All right.
I don't know what's going on after that, but yeah.
All right. That would be a good one.
Yeah.
Then they said, who else are you speaking to? And I said, and they said, all right, we want to give you a job offer right now.
Okay.
And I was very calm. And then,
but you didn't live in LA. You were just
I came in
for interviews.
Basically for interviews.
Yep.
And I got my demo tapes done at MG Video Conversions on Venice Boulevard and
right, because you were probably PAL, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So I got one done in the UK, and it turned out it wasn't very good. So I brought a PAL one and an NTSC one. And then when I got the conversions done here, they were better. So
got it.
Anyway. So, yeah, it was on the corner of Westwood Boulevard and Venice.
Okay.
It's now a, I don't know what they do. Yeah, it's a vaping place now, apparently.
Probably.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them now.
Yeah. So, well, it's a natural route. You know, video conversions, vaping.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure.
Yeah. So from there, they gave me a job offer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went down to my car and screamed really loudly. And I hope they didn't hear me as mm-hmm. I drove away being king of the castle. And then, but then at that point, the H-1B visa thing got closed down. Dun, dun, dun. And I was speaking to Diata Grant a lot.
Yeah.
Right? And then it took like 9 months to get me across and letters and all this. And Jim Cameron had to write a letter.
And seriously?
Yeah, it was crazy. And wow. then I showed that to my mom and she was crying. I'm like, Mom, he didn't write, it's just nice words, not really, you know.
Yeah. So he just signed his name at the
moment. Exactly. Yeah. So but it was very cool. Yeah. So anyway, on my first day here, I got the tour around like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was wandering around a little bit later and I saw Scott Ross's office and I thought, oh, Scott Ross. Scottish name,
mm-hmm.
not Scottish guy. But then, anyway, I just walked in and started chatting with him. And he said, oh, yeah, it's always open. Da, 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 da. And he said, oh, you're the guy that's taken like 9 months to get across here, yeah? And he went, and he was joking, but kind of not joking, but kind of joking. He was like, hope you're worth it.
Yeah.
That sounds like a Scott Ross thing, yeah. I remained friends with him since then. And then there was a Halloween party.
Yeah.
And I... That was an eye opener.
Yeah.
Yeah. I lost my underwear that time. I actually had a kilt on. And okay. then I put underwear that was tartan underwear so that it would match. Not
right.
knowing if it wouldn't be cool to not wear underwear because you're not supposed to wear underwear.
Right.
But I don't know. Maybe someone knows. Maybe someone out here. Maybe this could be my final.
Well, I know that
somebody on this
Andy Wilkoff was not wearing underwear.
Wow. But at the end of the night, he's got my underwear.
Well, do you remember he was telling me the story because he was on the podcast and he was recording the thing where he basically talks about he accidentally flashed someone and that's it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So somebody called me from Foundation Imaging and said, have you heard about this guy who was flashing? He's flashed Jim Cameron.
Right.
And I was like, and then I was like, I had this flash like, oh, my God, that was me.
That was you.
That was me. Scott Ross. I think Stan Winston was there. I can't remember. But I remember flashing Jim Cameron. Yeah. And Scott Ross. I don't know if that helped me or not in my career.
Okay.
You know, I don't know.
Well, you're doing pretty well. Let's all just look at that as a positive.
Oh, yeah. That's what I mean. That's what my doctor told me to say.
Exactly. All right. Well, so you were at DD, and that's, I guess, where you and I met. But you have been at DD a long time. Yeah. How long were you at DD for?
Wow, I can't remember. 96 to about 2000.
96, so that is literally like 3 years into DD.
Really?
Yeah, DD was 93 was when it started.
97? I think it was 96. I think I got there in 97.
Okay.
Jeez, I can't remember. You know that? That's really bad. Now, was that 1896 or was it 90?
I mean, that's a long time ago,
yeah.
which is fine. I think that's the part of the history that's important. But yeah, it's interesting. So you went into the commercial business.
Yeah. Right? Now, here's the thing. I went into the NT division. We were the Renegades.
The
NT division.
Literally, it was called the NT division.
And we had a
because
sign.
Because it was Windows as
NT.
Opposed to
SGI.
SGIs.
Yeah.
That's so stupid.
It was really dumb. But the funny thing was, I remember there was all these different factions. It was awful.
Yeah.
And it never helped anyone. I just think we're all a little bit young at that time, hot-headed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all calmed down now. But at the time, that being NT, we all loved being NT. We're NT. Mm-hmm. We had all these little tools that we'd write. And, you know, Lesniak would write things. And we'd have these awesome things. Like, how the hell did he do that?
Right.
And then we'd all get into trouble because we were doing things we're not supposed to.
Yep.
And then none of the tools would work for us because it was all command line. Well, and they're like, well, just use the command line. It's like, well, I don't have a machine to do that. Or it didn't work properly on NT. And then Daniel Maskett and the rest of the guys slowly like wrote all the tools that came over.
Right.
But we still always felt like the rejects at that. Well, not rejects.
Sure.
I didn't want to say gingerhead stepchild because that would offend stepchildren and gingerhead and everyone.
Right.
So I won't say that.
Yep.
I didn't say it. But basically, that's what it felt like. But we felt like we were kicking ass and doing things that the the features division would need something more structured, and we were winging it by the seat of our pants, and it worked. Right. For the majority of things, it worked.
Right.
So we were trying a lot of new things, and it was cool. And it was interesting because we were getting some really new work. We did, I remember back then with that was actually one of some of the first jobs. I worked on Supernova at the beginning, which is I don't think that's a good film.
No, but it was an important film for Digital Domain's future.
Oh.
Because this is what I remember when I was there, was like, Supernova was not the best film, but it was the one that got him out of the red.
Oh, really?
Yes, because it was post-Titanic.
Mm, which was a dead...
Which was a very red show.
Yeah, yeah.
And Supernova was not a big show, but there was enough profit made that it got Didi out of the red.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yep.
That's cool.
So it's the only reason. It's not necessarily... Like, you know, you should look at that show as like, okay, it wasn't the best film, but we all got to keep our jobs.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's interesting. I had no idea about that.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I wasn't there during that time, but I heard that from a few people there who told me the history. I was like, all right, I'll have some respect for Supernova.
And also, it was one of the last where they built like a full, not full scale spaceship, but a large model.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and then it was digital and all sorts of different
things. That was the model. Eric Nash?
Yeah, Eric Nash.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Eric Crash Nash is what it is.
That was fun and games back then. That was you know, obviously me coming in from Scotland, yeah. A new boy, what's going on? It seemed like lots of cool things were happening.
Yeah.
You know? It was very interesting.
So how did you get into directing then?
Well, that's the thing. That's been my problem.
Right.
Is that I remember talking to Andy Hall a long time ago.
Yeah.
And he said, so it was like our third day in, because we both started on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, I want to just make things. I don't know what I want to do yet. Mm-hmm. He goes, I want to direct. I'm like, oh, really? And I said, direct CG? And he goes, I don't know. That's what I want to do. I'm like, oh, good on you. Because he had a direction.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. He had a single line that he wanted to do.
Yeah, I got it.
And,
I got the pun too.
Yeah. Where's the little symbol with the psh?
Well, I got shock mounts, so you can't hear it.
Oh. I'm going to get my iPhone out and get that. Anyway, so, but what was interesting at that moment, I realized, I like making things. And I think I always have done.
Uh-huh.
I've always liked making music. But I realized that not doing one thing in LA is not really desirable in that kind of way. Doing multiple things, which I think is a shame. But I understand why it has to be that way. But, you know, we were doing car commercials, like the first CG car, first CG environment, first CG car, you know, that's been spoken about before.
Mm-hmm.
And that was cool, trying all the new things. But it was actually Kelly Port came up with this idea called the 100 Monkeys Project.
Okay.
It was something like that. But basically, we were going to shoot 100 short films in a year or something. It was one of those things, you know, they do 100 things with this. And we didn't get that many, but we had a whole bunch of people that wanted to make things and do things. And I found that really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, years earlier, back in Edinburgh, a good friend of mine, family friend, Steve Frame, his mum took us to this thing called the Edinburgh Animation Workshop.
Okay.
And we did cut-out cell animation with these little wires and figurines.
Okay.
And we made this story about this two hitchhikers, and they fell down this shaft, and this bad demon guy was like, you basically had to sacrifice the other guy to get out.
Okay.
Yeah, it was kind of deep, but then it turned out that you sacrificed that guy. You're the one that died. And we called it Satan's Shaft. Didn't really realize that the name isn't so good at that point,
right.
But that really got us in. There was another one called King Wingnut that we did. It was got these nuts and we sprayed them with silver paint. And,
okay.
And it was all this forced perspective, all with you know, 16 mil and 8 mil, click, click, click,
doing
all that stop frame animation. And I really liked doing that. But I didn't put two and two together until I got older, is that when we were doing that 100 Monkeys project,
mm-hmm.
I really liked the idea of like, oh, I get it now. I like doing this stuff, but I also like doing that.
Right.
And I like doing the music and I want to edit it. And
yep.
that's the problem.
Right. You
know? So, but then it was actually after that at Digital Domain, you do, obviously, when I did a series of commercials for Pennzoil. And it was through the director's called Baker Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And he was great because he didn't think I was the fool. No, he didn't. He knew I wasn't really a threat to him. He was had a great roster of, he had a great background and everything of different things. And he's a great comedic director.
Okay.
And I looked through all this stuff. I'm like, this guy is just brilliant. In fact, I'd already kind of like had a list of like commercials that I'd seen on TV and recorded and kept them. And they were basically all his. And I didn't know. So anyway, we got a chance to do this animation of these Pennzoil engines, and then we basically grouped them all up, like give them different feelings and different movements and different kind of lumbering, like the big V8, a big heavy thing, a little Japanese like this, and we basically made them into different dogs, like the big bloodhound like this.
I remember this.
Yeah, we did all that, and we really did, and we did also, it was the first time we did the gamma right linear workflow.
Yes.
Which made them look really good. You know, it did make a big difference to when we were doing our workflow.
You used to render everything that way,
Yeah. And so basically, I really got to, well, we all really, all of the animators did a really good job at animating this. And Chris DeSantis was really good in there. Ron Herbst was in there. They were, all just did fantastic jobs.
Yeah.
And then what we also got to do was on the shoot, they were having to animate a physical car with pneumatics, and they didn't do it right. And I was like, no. So I had this big foam core engine and I was animating it on set. And I was like, the car has to go down and then lift up. You can't have it going. You've got the weight of an engine hanging on it. It's going to go down and it's going to lift it. You know, so on the first commercial, Baker Smith was very involved. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the second one, he says, just you go do it. Just, I'll be over here. You're going to do way. I'm done. I'm totally happy. I complete. And he basically, not, the acting, he was doing all that, but all the animation of the live action stuff was really handed over to me. And at the end of it, he thanked me. He's like, you did that commercial. I didn't do anything.
Wow.
And he told Ed Ulbrich Gabby and all that. And, you know, and then from there, I started to direct the smaller 60-second ones. This is through Shy at Day. So it was. It was with Richard O'Neill.
It
was fantastic. He was the producer for 1984, the Apple 1984 commercial.
Oh my God.
And I've remained friends with him for a long time. He was fundamental to me getting in and doing these directing
gigs. Okay. Yeah.
And I was always on the timing and the audio and all that kind of stuff. I was a real stickler for getting all that right. And so he brought me along to these sessions, and Baker Smith wasn't there, but I was, and I was like, no, let's do this. And he really saw me as being a stickler. In fact, on the PAL conversion, we were in company three and I was looking at it and we're just about to go home. Everything was finished.
Mm-hmm.
We're going home. And then he looked at me and he went, something's wrong, isn't it? I'm like, no, it's fine. No, it's fine. He goes, no, it's not. Tell me what's wrong. And I was like, it's off by a frame. It's off by a frame. It's easy to see. It's off by frame. Nobody else is seeing. This is just me. And so we had to relay down all these ones, all the different versions and like that, and move them all back a frame because something happened with the PAL conversion.
Oh my
gosh. The
timing
was off by frame. And so he trusted me. And so he brought me in and a lot of other things. And that's where I really started directing. And then that's when I realized it wasn't that mentality. I remember when there was a lot of young VFX guys really feeling that the director, I could do that. And the guy doesn't do anything. I can do it easy. But it's not about that. It's about the relationships and it's about the people and it's about how you interact with them and how you can make them feel comfortable, you know? And so, and dealing with clients is, I think at that point then, we were always worried about rendering and how we're going to do things. But that was more just about how much rendering stuff we just needed more of the farm, you know? And I remember even on 9/11, I was there in the morning. No one was there. And the horrible part went through my brain was like, I have access to the whole farm. Nobody's here. And that's horrible, right? But that's the kind of thing. We just needed more access to the farm back then. That's what we were doing. So it wasn't like we couldn't do it. But my point for saying that was a lot of it was dealing with a client. And you know, and I think, you know, we were going then there and our ability to deal with these clients were sometimes really quite unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
I was way more naive. I was good. I could talk to them. I was okay at that. But I think that was more of a challenge for me to keep that going. Not so much doing the directing and keeping the animation going, because back then, you know, you're directing and then you're still doing the animation and you're still dealing with the clients. You're doing all that stuff at the same time.
Right.
And that's, you know, but I've really found that dealing with clients was just as much a big of a headache as dealing with the technical side.
Yeah. That's true.
And then we did Medal of Honor. We did a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. And then we did the Disney stuff with Joe Pitka. And
which Disney stuff?
The Disney 50th anniversary stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And that was a big challenge, too, because that was a whole...
what was Pitka like?
Oh, I've got a story about that one.
Yeah, someone always has a Pitka story.
So here's the thing. So this is going away from visual effects and just going to straight. At that time, I was making a short film. It was a statement piece. It was called Liberation, and it was about how, you know, America uses all this oil and how we're so dependent on oil, but how many countries we're in and how many countries we're meddling with. And it's all because of oil, and it's because of, you know, the messed up kind of power that it has. And, and I made a statement about that. And it was about, Gaddafi, Bin Laden, Bush, all of that. And it was a short piece. It was just an opinion piece. And it was really showing, the atrocities of war all because of oil. Now, this was right before YouTube. Have you heard of YouTube?
Is this thing? Yes, I have heard of it.
It's very popular.
It's popular.
All the kids are... Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. That YouTube thing.
Yeah.
It's not clockwork also, by the way.
It's come to the United States as well.
Oh, really?
It's not just now. In Nairobi.
Wow. That is amazing. It's everywhere. Goodness. And it's not clockwork. It's electronic.
Yep.
Yeah. So I made this piece, and we were in the umpteenth meeting, because Joe Pitka just worked across the road at his place.
Right.
He'd always come for meetings.
That's right. Yeah.
And he'd come in and totally insult Gabby and totally insult Ed. Mm-hmm. And then he'd look at me and he'd say, "Where are your subtitles?" Like this, because you'll think I'd have subtitles underneath me.
Right.
And then he was going on and on and on. I was taking notes. But at the same time, I just hosted this video on an FTP site that you could watch videos on this FTP site before YouTube. Mm-hmm. And the guy had come back to me and said, "Oh, something's blah, 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 blah." And I had to look at it, and I was just watching it. And then Joe saw me looking at the screen. He goes, "Turn your laptop around right now. Take your hands off it. Turn it around." Mm-hmm. And Gabby turned around to me, Ed turns like, "What the hell have you done? You've upset the monster."
Right.
"God damn it." And so I turned the screen around. He went, "What's that? Rewind it. Play it back from the beginning." And I was like, "Oh crap, I am so screwed."
Yeah.
And we played it, and he went, "It's about oil. You probably don't even, do you know what this is?" I went, I don't know. He goes, "You probably wouldn't understand." And he's playing it, and he played the whole thing. He goes, "What idiot doesn't put his name at the end of that? That was fantastic. Rewind it, play it again." Like this. And I'm like, "Oh God." And we play the whole thing again. He goes, "That's really good. What idiot wouldn't put his name at the end of that?" He says, "Do you know," and he was looking at me going, "Do you not even know what that was about?" And I'm like, "I didn't see it. It was just, this isn't mine." Mm-hmm. Right? And he goes, "Oh." He goes, "Right, screw you guys, I'm out." And he got up and left, right? Because he was done with his meeting and shouting at people. And so I ran. I didn't let Ed or Gabby see this, but I walked out and I went to him and I went, "I did that. I made it." He went, "What?" "I made that." Mm-hmm. And he put his hand out and he shook my hand. He went, "Get a fucking copy to my desk in 10 minutes. I went, "Shit." Okay. And I did. And I got it dubbed and put on the Digibeta.
Oh my God.
And got it. So, and
does since, Ed know that?
Huh?
Does Ed know that you did that?
He does now. Listening. God. So, and I remember who was in the tape room. Nick. Was it Nick? Or was it Nar? Who was it that laid it down at the tape for me? "I've got to do this." And he goes, "What is it?" I go, "You got to do this thing for me." Like this. And then since that moment, Joe Pitka was super nice to me. Super, super nice.
Wow.
Like I was in. And Brad Parker, I told Brad Parker.
Yeah.
And he was like, "Yeah, you've got in. You're good. Now he sees you as a real person."
Right.
Just, you know, watch out for the monster, but now you're in, you're good.
Right.
And he was super good to me. He'd ask me things all the time. And there was some stuff that would happen on set. That guy did a handshake with the devil or something, because some amazing stuff would happen just right in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. And I've got multiple people that have told me stories of just some incredible stuff that happened.
Wow.
With Joe Pitka that would just happen just as he's rolling.
Yeah.
And then he'd go cut, and then he'd walk out, and then he'd be getting his car to drive away. Go to this other shot, you know. But anyway, so we did the 50th anniversary, and that was Angie Jones and Scott.
Yeah.
Really, really great. She was amazing.
Yeah,
you know?
Angie.
And
yeah.
Then there was a bunch of other people. Laura Barbera was on that. There was a bunch of great people, and and then also Lee England.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. There was a great bunch of great people.
Yeah.
You know. So, and that, but we, I think we really got to, like, for instance, I was going out and with a guy called Jason Lafargo, who's his DP and first AD.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Jason went out and shot a whole bunch of plates. And then, and it was just me and him in the back of his pickup truck.
Right.
With a stabilized head and a whatever. Yeah. Right? It was one of those ones that you use for being on a boat.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
Back in the day. And we ended up just going and filming this different stuff over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And the producer on that side was Sheila Teague, who then went on to rep me in her own thing. And so we were just kind of winging it and doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, I remember Joe had everyone in the room and he just went around and, you know, you were horrible. You, I don't know who you are. You were terrible. You just... Everyone, it was kind of like a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Fred Romandi and went, you're terrible like this. And Fred was like holding himself because Fred had obviously worked very hard to mm-hmm. work on that job because it wasn't an easy job.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came to me and he went, you, I didn't know you wore glasses. Those look cuter on you. And then he went to the next person. Wow. And everyone turned to me like, the hell did you do?
Right.
You know, so that was interesting. But that was, I feel that was a lot of, I think Angie Jones did a lot in terms of putting in direction and stuff.
Sure.
But then we also got Eric Rosenberg, Eric Greenberg. He was one of the famous 12. Okay. He came down and added in all his, he was one of the famous like Disney animators. And he came down,
right.
Put Brett, just gave us a lot of knowledge.
Sure. Know?
But that was those, it was those commercials that really started me, to answer your question, was those ones that really started me down that direction of doing more directing.
Right, interesting. Well, I was always liked, you know, the fact that you were a very knowledgeable director. You would run out of seat of your pants. You would find opportunities or resources that were available. And it was, you know, ironically, coming back to like the, when we, you know, was at before I was working at this company, I was doing that Vera IRL commercial. I'm like, oh shit, Chris is doing a commercial, doing a music video, and I'm gonna go steal some of his models to do this IRL thing. And you were so cool about it. You were really great.
That was just good fun. I mean, those kind of things. You always, when you hear something is going on, I was like, yeah, of course, that's gonna be. It's just more. It's better.
Yeah, yeah.
And those things end up. I've learned. To when you hear of other things happening that are coming your way, you let them happen.
Yep.
You and those things I've had many other things that have happened that are not too dissimilar that have just been the most amazing stuff only because you let the door open.
Sure.
And that's why that was really good fun. And also the girl that was in that video, she'd just come from church.
Really?
And yeah, she was just from church, and then she was doing all the shaking of the all that stuff. Yeah.
She
and
was in a rap video.
Apparently, after that, she wanted to go back to church.
Right.
To
repent her sins.
Yeah.
But
that was really good fun. That was just a good day. It was for a music video where I was helping kind of usher this young director called Bobby, who's staying with us.
Mm-hmm.
At our house, we had a lot of young people that we were kind of helping and bringing along and allowing to be creative. And we found that because we had good jobs, we were letting this happen. And this is where a lot of our youth kind of work really started.
Right.
And we found that it was just really exciting seeing what could come from it, not knowing that there was a goal. There wasn't really a goal. The goal kind of formed, or a destination kind of formed as we were going along, when we're realizing that some of these people could do stuff, work with us, other things that could happen. And so he was one of our guys. He was a young director, really absolutely knowledgeable about film to the nth degree. He's a real film guy. I mean, I think I know a bit about films and can pick out why certain things have happened and know, you know, different choices about movies over the years. I've got a pretty good, you know, knowledge of those things, but this guy's bananas, absolutely unbelievable.
That's awesome.
So we helped him do that music video, and I was just pleased that Greg allowed us to be
in his backyard. It's perfect timing because I went to Greg and I said, hey, I need a place, you know, you mentioned we could use your place for this scene, and I didn't have the talent. I needed two female actresses to play the roles of the pool girls. And I was like, yeah, I can't do that because Chris Blythe is going to be here shooting a rap video and he's got about 20 girls in bikinis. I was like, wait, did you say what? Say that last part again.
Yeah,
let me call Chris.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was awesome. But I want to figure out, you know, how this led you to go to Nairobi. How long have you been in Nairobi now?
It's going on 7 years now.
Yeah. So how did you end up there?
So what I was working as creative director at Riot, which is now Method.
Yes.
And Tilo, my wife, she was working in production. She does all sorts of formats and she's really good at that. And she's a great producer and she comes up with concepts and, and puts things together that she makes, you know, one and one equal 10. Mm-hmm. And she kind of said, well, okay, you're going to do that. Is that what we're going to do now? Is that it? Is this the end? We're just going to be here. And I'm like, yeah, it's LA. Woohoo. And she's like, no, I want to do something else. Got to do, this can't just be it.
Okay.
So she went she said, well, I'm going to go on. And she found this person who was going to Morocco to find these young boys that were doing, they were at an orphanage and they were basically they were like 15, 16 years getting into trouble. Mm-hmm. And she came up with this idea of getting a whole bunch of bikes and making a bike business by getting some bike guys in from New York to teach them about repairing bikes. They called it the Tangerine Bike Project. Mm-hmm. And so it was a huge success. And I gave Tilo a little small Panasonic 24P camera and it's a great little case and batteries. I said, just film what you can. Just let's see what we can make a little piece out of it. And she came back and she goes, oh my God, it was just amazingly successful. You know, the mayor was in, it's all been like verified. It's now proper business. These boys are now, you know, they're now concentrating. They're fixing all these bikes. It's it's a great business. It's made impact. That's what she wants to do, is make impact. I'm like, okay, I can't wait to see the footage from the camera. She went, oh, yeah, I didn't actually take it out of its box. I just filmed everything on my phone. I'm like, oh, so we don't have any record and we're kind of we're filmmakers. We make things and we don't have anything. So we thought, well, why don't we figure something else? Why don't we use our filmmaking skills to create impact, to help? We're sick of seeing those films from Africa of all the, you know, the tears and the big tummy and the sad child and the crying. And it was always like that. Always just, why would you want to put any money into that? Why would you want to donate to that? All it does, it looks like it's doing nothing. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to make stories that showed promise and kind of hope.
Right.
And so we went through a whole bunch of different NGOs, finding ones that needed help, that had really horrible videos, but had a good mission. And also had an exit plan. We didn't want to have people that just want to keep themselves there and have a job forever.
Right.
So we found one. And then on my 40th birthday, we went to Tanzania and filmed this.
Okay.
Yeah. She said, I was like, oh, we're going to Africa to go and shoot some animals, film some animals on for your 40th. But we're going to do this documentary at the same time. And so we did this documentary and it created such a huge impact for that NGO.
Yeah.
That we kind of edited some stuff when we were there and we're like, we're onto something here.
Yes.
So that's where we're like, so we said, right, why don't we do this then? From at that moment, we kind of said, we're on this little beach area after filming and we're like, okay, we can see this is going to work. And this is before we even got the results. This is before we actually finished it.
Okay.
And we said, that's what we're going to do. We're going to find stories and we're going to make them and we're going to do it for free and we're going to work back in LA and then we're going to do this on the side. This is going to be cool. Right?
Right.
We called it Good Makers Films. Bam. Within 48 hours, it literally happened in front of us. Somebody said, oh, we talked to, well, this is what we're going to do now. And this woman said, oh, I know who you should speak to. You should speak to this guy called Dr. Frank. I'm like, oh, who's that? Turned out it was this guy who basically almost died on Mount Kilimanjaro on his 50th birthday.
Oh, wow.
And basically then left his California home, sold everything he had, and moved to Africa to build a hospital.
Okay.
And we then went and filmed that story. And,
yes.
And then they got a lot of donations, so much so that they didn't have to come back to the States to get donations. They would give just DVDs out or show them the link on YouTube, and then the money would come. And so we start doing it for all these other projects over there, and we find that we were going back and forwards a lot.
Yep.
And that was cool. And then, so we got this job. Tilo said, I want to stay there for a little period of time, like, you know, 3 or 4 months. Let's just stay there for a bit. It'll be fun. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, let's look for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And then there's a project with Southwest Airlines, which is basically they've got 700 planes, each got 148 seats, and all the seats were leather. Mm-hmm. And they realized they were heavy as anything. They're like really heavy. And they're like, wait a minute, this stuff's heavy. And they realized that the carbon footprint was really heavy, even with an empty plane. So they replaced all the seats with this lightweight material. And then they had 148 seats times 700 planes of leather, which works out to be 42 acres of leather that they couldn't get rid of in the States for some reason.
Okay.
So basically, it turned out that one of the guys from Southwest Airlines, he's a white guy from, he's from Seattle, mm-hmm. but he grew up in Kenya, and he goes, I know plenty of companies out there that would take this mm-hmm. material. So we did a test, and they said, who's going to film this? Who's going to do this program? And they contacted us to do that. And it was Tilo organized like 15 different projects. So basically, we got these young kids that were in an orphanage. We mm-hmm. trained them how to use leather. Mm-hmm. And then we got them to go work in a leather as apprentices in this company that made leather shoes. Mm-hmm. And those leather shoes are then given to children that don't have closed-toed shoes. And those closed-toed shoes kids can't walk to school because they get infections. So we're taking young orphans who are young in their teens now.
Right.
They were then getting trained to then do this other stuff and then help these.
So the Southwest seats turned into shoes.
Yeah, shoes, backpacks, bangles. And then we also sold a whole bunch of the leather back to Southwest Airlines as makeup bags for the 25,000 of them we made, makeup bags for the air hostesses.
Wow.
So we did a whole bunch of other projects as well. But that was supposed to be 2 months on and off here and there.
Wow.
But the leather got stuck at the port because they wanted to take it and keep it and do things with it.
Yes. Yeah.
And so at that moment, we were basically waiting. And we'd done some other projects in the States, youth projects, kind of impact projects. And we did various different projects. And but we found that it was more effective there than doing them here. We had a lot of difficulties doing them here.
Yeah.
And that's a bigger story. But basically, we found them more effective. We made more impact there. And we were working in Tanzania, Uganda, but we liked Kenya.
Right.
So then from there, we basically were stuck waiting for this leather to come in. And somebody said, hey, do you want to do some commercials? And I'm like, oh man, the last thing I want to do is commercials in Kenya, right?
Right.
And I was like, oh. But anyway, it turned out it was a cool new idea.
Okay.
And we basically, to cut a long story short, made arguably one of the most successful advertising campaigns ever in Kenya.
Really?
Yeah. It was massive.
Wow.
Absolutely meteoric.
For what? What was the product?
It was basically, it's in about 200 different countries, but it's not in the States. It's called OLX.
Okay.
And it's basically Craigslist, but organized by a company. And it's got a better interface. And the whole deal is you put your stuff on this thing, and but if you pay like 5 cents, you're whatever thing that you want to sell will be visible at the top.
Interesting.
You know, so we made this cool advertising campaign that really changed the mindset, because people weren't, you don't sell anything in Kenya. You don't give anything away because it looks like it doesn't, you keep it or it looks like you're poor.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Anyway, we hit their 1 year goal in 5 weeks, and we hit their 2 year goals in 15 weeks, and it was just this meteoric thing. So then after that, we got calls to do other commercials, and I'm like, oh, because there's no budget there. The money is just silly, right? Compared to what it is here. But then we did this commercial, Don't Drink and Drive commercial, which is still shown to this day. Everyone knows this commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just your replacement. It's like life moves on when you're gone. It was a fine, we came up with the idea. Okay, it's fine.
Right.
But it turned out it was like really, really good.
Good.
So all these young people that have been working with over the years, we now kind of hired them as staff.
Awesome.
So to wrap this up real quick, Tila was out there, and she was asked by the Red Cross to work on the peace campaign for the elections. The elections in Kenya are usually really polarizing. People usually, you know, it's really volatile. Lots of people died in the last one. Mm-hmm. There was lots of troubles happened. So they looked for Tila to come up with some ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, well, we should talk to the youth. Let's have a town hall meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, what's that? And went, town hall meeting. You get the kids around and see what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've not done one of those before.
Mm-hmm.
So but with a Kenyan accent. And but then, so they did that. And then we found there was just an amazing amount of young kids that are just got, you could tell they were so talented.
Right.
They just didn't have an outlet to do anything with it.
Right.
And so we decided to do something about that.
Interesting.
And that's when we started up our kind of, our live, it was supposed to be radio, but then New Tech contacted us and said, no, I do video.
Do TV.
And so I said, sure, give us some things. And they said, it's on its way. And they basically gave us a TriCaster. And then we started from there. I talked to Sony, and Sony gave us some cameras. And
wow.
Red have been very generous in the past as well with when they're filming. They'd always give us complete kits of gear, which is really nice of them.
That's amazing.
So basically, one thing led to another, and before we know it, we've got a whole platform of young people that are writing some incredible stuff, and mm-hmm. it's getting a lot of traction, and now people are really interested in what we've built.
Right.
Now, what we're also doing is, and this, I'm still, like, I'm now building, we have a full green screen studio, and we're doing virtual sets and all that kind of stuff, so I still okay. get to do all that. And then for any other TV intros, I'm still going back to my visual effects world and doing that, which is very, very, you know, different. But yep. I'm still trying to keep on top of things and building, you know, now I'm adding GPUs to things and that kind
you're,
of stuff.
You're still, that, you're still that same kid that was tinkering with the yeah. memory buses of yep. your computer, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to go away, even if you're in, you know, doing philanthropy in Nairobi. Yeah. You're still
well, now good. We're doing a project for Microsoft.
Okay.
And you, like, for instance, this is something you might not associate with being
associated with the Gates Foundation or not?
No, it's okay. it's totally separate. But what it is the amount of young programmers in Kenya mm-hmm. is stratospheric.
Really?
Yeah.
You Why? Wouldn't
believe it. We don't know. No one knows. There's just a lot of people that want to be programmers, and there are a lot of them. And so we've done these hackathons where we basically give them a task of something that we want to do, and we bring them in, and then we, like, say Uber came to us and said, well, we've got all this user data, we've got all the driver data. What can Right. What can we make from that? What can we understand from that? Figure out what to do with the data. And then present it to us. And so they have 24 hours to come back with a model of what they're going to do with this data.
Right.
And these kids have got, some of them have got brand new MacBook Pros. Others have got these old crappy PCs that have got like I saw one guy that only a part of his screen worked. So he put his Windows into the bottom right-hand corner where his screen still worked.
Oh my God.
And he had red tape around this huge power brick on this laptop. It was a really old laptop. But he was just coding away. And everyone's on an even playing field, really, even though the computer's messed up. Mm-hmm. And so you get some, in the same way that I found programming allowed me to kind of flatten my brain out and, like, I could think clearly.
Yeah.
I think programming really democratizes and, flattens the playing field.
Yeah, absolutely.
To a certain degree out there. And so there's some young, really amazing people out there.
That's
and you wouldn't believe the amount. So we're now doing a thing called Spotlight AI Kenya, which is a weekly show about the different applications of AI in East Africa.
That's insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And so I actually went, we had to build a Microsoft set.
Okay.
So I looked at all the architecture for the different Microsoft campuses in Dublin and Oslo and all over the States. And I found there's certain techniques and certain things that they did in different places. And then from there, I just built it in 3D and then lit it and figured out, well, the one under the atrium, that's where people are leisure. And then from the out of the light, that's meeting spaces. And then in the darker areas over there, that's where they actually get the work. And I laid it all out and did different tables and looked at the way I downloaded all this stuff from, mm-hmm. I looked at the way they'd built it. I looked at the architects and I saw the different furniture and I just downloaded it off the net and populated it and made it look nice and then made it look like a Microsoft building.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys from Microsoft saw it and went, oh, where's that? I went, my job is done.
Nice.
So, and it's in the background now of the virtual set. And now they're going to do another show called Just Tech, mm-hmm. where they're talking about new tech stuff. So it's really interesting the amount of stuff that we're doing.
So you're doing TV shows.
Now we're doing TV shows. And now we're talking with Microsoft to do other stuff right now. Mm-hmm. We've got, we're talking with an esports gaming company that to do, and that is just bananas. So even figuring that out on a technical level is interesting. I still like making the things, though. I mean, I can only, building stuff and putting stuff together is great, but if I'm not creating something new or coming up with something visual, that, I like to do that more often.
You have to share that analogy because it was really funny, but also really amazing at the same time. Because you and I were talking about esports.
Hmm.
Everyone knows the story of Kenyan marathoners because Kenyan marathoners train at a higher altitude where you're deprived of oxygen. So therefore, when you come down to a place which is more oxygen, you excel, right?
Yeah.
Which is the classic thing, right? But you had the story of people in Kenya in the esports world who are deprived, who have shitty internet.
And bad ping and lag.
Bad ping. So they've got 150, 300 ping or something, which is terrible.
Yeah.
And they still play. But then when they get to a place that is actually really good ping, they kick ass.
Exactly.
It's basically the same
analogy. It's the same analogy, but just like in a digital form. It's actually quite cool, isn't it?
I love this idea. Yeah. It's like, that's the oxygen deprivation, high ping.
Yeah.
It's oxygen deprivation. And I think it's amazing, you know, but I think that's the truth of a lot of places there where resources are scarce, be it oxygen, be it ping, be it shoes, whatever it is, you somehow become more innovative. You somehow find ways around the situation or your body adapts to that situation that when you're introduced to something where that restriction is taken away, you excel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And also I don't even realize that, but even living in Kenya, we are living at altitude. If you take
the highest
mountain in Scotland is Ben Nevis. Okay. And you go up there and there's like oxygen tanks and all this stuff. And do you want last 10 seconds out there in the cold?
Yeah.
And then, that was Scottish, by the way.
Right.
then you, Nairobi's higher than Ben Nevis.
Right.
By quite a factor.
Right.
But you don't realize it. But I have to admit, where my house is, it's up like 6 floors and there's no elevator.
Okay.
That last like 8 steps, I've been there for all those last 8 steps. I'm like, holy moly. And it's just that just the lack of it. It is. So you still feel it. But I totally know exactly what you mean. And I think there's, you know, what people don't know with East Africa, or actually Africa in general, is that 85% of the population is under 25. Wow. And because we've now got a hangover now of, in just one generation back, people were having 7 or 8 kids because they would die. There was, you know, things like, now they're not dying. Now, so those are already born and those are now all growing up. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe the new ones only have 1 or 2 brothers and sisters. There's less. People are having less kids now. But that bulge has already happened. That amount of people is now going to be growing up.
Right.
And there's the amount of workforce that's going to be available. And for me, it's very interesting from an industrial point of view. Well, not industrial, but I can see training the visual effects community out there could be the next workforce.
Right.
Now, here's the thing. Out in Kenya, there are some guys that are doing some really good work.
Sure.
Yeah, they're using Nuke Studio and they're using, you know, they're using V-Ray and they're using, some of them using Cinema 4D, some are using Mac, some of them are using Maya. You know, everyone's using different versions of cracked software.
Right.
But it is interesting that some of the guys that are out there that are doing really, really, Komi and Jim Karatu are doing great work at them. There's some really, so you get some real novel approaches. And you're right, the way that we haven't do the same things. We our workstations for doing editing were just Mac Minis from 2012, but they were 16 gigs with quad-core i7s, which were not bad.
Right.
But now what we've found is that even though the CPUs have got a little bit better, not really crazy better, a lot better, but not like the same way that GPUs have, now we're attaching GPUs and hacking them so that those little Mac Minis have got like a nice decent graphics card, and those machines are just flying.
They're screaming.
It's crazy. It shouldn't work, dude. It shouldn't work. I had
2012 Mac Mini with a GPU attached. Well,
let's put it this way. There's one Thunderbolt port, and it's a Thunderbolt 1 port.
Okay.
And I'm going to my cinema display. Mm-hmm. And then from that has a Thunderbolt port, which is then going to my LTO tape machine.
So it's basically serial.
Serial. And then from there, it's going to my GPU.
Right.
Here's the crazy part, which shouldn't work. On my monitor that's the external on the GPU, I'm running, say, Valley or whatever like that. Mm-hmm. And it's running at 30, 40 frames a second. Mm-hmm. And then I'm running Final Cut and DaVinci at 4K. And it's all working.
On a Mac Mini.
On a Mac Mini. And I've got this videoed. Now, here's the crazy part. And I don't know how this can even work. I have my GPU, which is at the end of the Thunderbolt chain. Mm-hmm. But if I'm running Resolve, it uses the GPU on my cinema display.
So how is it going there and back?
I don't know, but it works, and it works
fast.
I had like layered up like 3 or 4 layers, and I put like different effects on, text effects.
You shouldn't be running Resolve on a Mac Mini.
It works fine. It works absolutely fine. At 4K, no problem. And we've got a fast connection to our
what
server.
GPUs are you using?
Well, this is where it gets even better. So if you look at the Mac Mini, it's a Thunderbolt 1 port.
Yes.
Right. So if you put something like, you know, some Titan or something, it's not going to, or some, you know, 1050 or 1070, whatever, those aren't going to make any difference.
Okay.
Because it's way faster than the Thunderbolt 1 port anyway.
Right.
So you put in some old, from circa 2012, 7970s.
Really?
And they work absolutely fine.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
And what are you putting it into, some kind of a bay that holds it?
Yeah, I've got this Sonnet make this great eGPU breakaway box, and it's got like this 500 odd. You're gonna five. I think I've got the 650 or the 550 watt power supply in it.
Okay.
And you know, do all the plugs and everything.
Okay.
And it shouldn't work. It shouldn't work.
No.
Now what I've got is, now I've built myself a new one. Mm. I've got one of those nukes, those little Intel nukes.
Yes, I've heard of
it. It's got the 8th generation quad core i7, mm-hmm. 32 gigs of RAM, mm-hmm. super fast RAM, and I got the super fast
SSD.
MO2, not the normal SSD, but mm-hmm. you know, the stick SSD. Mm-hmm. It's super fast. And it's got a Thunderbolt 3 port.
Oh,
on
so
it.
Now you can actually put a full size GPU.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm gonna do it maybe this week. I've got all the bits sitting in my rental apartment, and I'm gonna just test that out. I'm actually gonna put it to Mojave, mm-hmm. and just plug it in and see what it's like. And now here's the thing: I know the results. I actually haven't got a graphics card. I need to get one this week, unless anyone has one lying around.
Come talk to me after the show.
All right.
But you have to return it.
Okay. I'm smiling nicely right now with my sweet smile.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See, that's my sweet smile. Look at that.
Yeah, yeah.
Who can refuse this?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's been a funny trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome. Well, listen, I'm sure there's a lot more we can cover, but we've gone well over an hour, believe it or not.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I thought it was like 18 minutes.
1 hour and 18 minutes.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
We can chat, it seems.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's absolutely great. No, I this is absolutely wonderful. And I was so glad when you messaged me. It's like, I'm going to be in town. And it's like, let's get together, drinks, dinner, lunch. And I said, lunch and a podcast. We're totally going to do that.
Lunch and podcast.
And so when you told me, it's like, I'm available like starting today. And I was like, how about today? It was, I mean, perfect. I think we literally planned this a few hours ago.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad you're able to do this.
I'm so glad I'm here.
And so I will let you know when this goes up. So if you have anything, is there anything you want people to share or see some of your stuff? Where was a good place for people to check out some of the work you've been doing?
I'd have to post it. I mean, we've got lots of different things going on. Our website's even just going through some transitions right now.
Sure.
It's called whatsgoodstudios.com. Okay. And then we've also got our actual platform, which is on wg.africa.
Okay.
Which is, it's called What's Good Networks, but it's right. What's Good. So people just call us WG.
Okay.
So we've got a two-letter domain name.
Oh, good.
WG.Africa.
.Africa. Wow. Yeah, okay.
It's kind of cool.
So a lot of people can check out some of that stuff there. And I think it's absolutely wonderful. And you're probably going to be in Kenya for the foreseeable future, it looks like.
Well, I like it here. There's no doubt about it. I think LA is, one thing I really like to put to everyone is that it's like when the fridge breaks down and you don't have a fridge anymore, you're like, man, that fridge was good. So I never had a problem with LA. I've always loved LA. I mean, it took me many years to get here.
Sure.
But, and I've always appreciated it. And yeah, of course you have your down, oh, I'm goddamn LA. But I really realized that the ease of doing things is so nice here. It's just very, very easy to go buy things and do things and be a consumer.
Sure.
And it's different now.
Welcome to capitalism.
Yeah, but when Kenya gets Amazon, it'll all be changed.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And that will happen because it's literally a marketplace that's about to happen. But
right.
I think living in Nairobi is really, I love it. It's really exciting and mm-hmm. it's got lots of challenges. It's, as I said, it's like the Wild West.
Yep.
You have to, you know, be careful.
Sure.
On many different aspects in business, in driving, and just being aware mm-hmm. certain things. But here's the thing, you know, you wouldn't be going down someplace in the east side of Los Angeles at night walking around, la 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 la, you just wouldn't. Well, you know, it's the same kind of thing.
Right.
And the same time when people hear of like bad things that are happening over there in Africa land, it's the same thing. If you hear something that happened on the east side of LA and you're sitting on the west side, you're like...
You assume that it's all of Los Angeles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, like my mom does when anything's on fire.
Right.
Yeah. So,
it's like, there's fires in Los Angeles. Yes. Yeah. You know that, and my mother lives in Connecticut. It's like, you realize that Los Angeles is the size of the entire state of Connecticut.
I think people don't understand. I show that to people like on Google Maps, yeah, which is great now, by the Google Earth is amazing now. And that's when you can really see the size of LA is just like, massive.
If there's absolutely no traffic in Los Angeles and I go from the north of Los Angeles to the south end of Los Angeles, it still takes you an hour and a half at full speed on the freeway.
On your Tesla.
It's a big city.
Yeah. But I love it here. I think for me coming back.
But you still sounds like you're going to go back to Nairobi and be there for a while.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be there for a while. I think I'm always about projects, and I think this is something that
I think it's wonderful what you're doing.
Thank you. I think it's really rewarding and it's good. And at some point it'll make money. No, no. I mean, you cover your base there a little differently than you do here.
Sure.
You the money for the way it is and how much it costs to live there is just totally different.
Sure.
You know, so we have to accept that kind of like difference in how much it pays because we're still doing very well.
Right.
And things are good. Right?
Right, right, right.
But comparing that same money to here is totally different. It doesn't make any kind of sense.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I think one of the things now that I do miss doing proper VFX projects. I do.
You do?
Yeah, and Tilo knows that too. It's like I'm whenever I get something new to bite into, it's great. I love getting, and then I do it, and then I'm like, okay, I would love to be in a position to come back here and do some projects, go back. You know, that would be ideal for me. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Chris, I really appreciate you coming.
It's been a pleasure.
This is awesome, and we'll let you know when this goes out.
All right.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks.